Thanks to the conference organizers for putting this together. I should note that this is joint work with Bruce Meyer from the University of Chicago. I thought I might start by sharing with you the evolution of the title of this paper, because some of you might know it from its well-known aliases. So it had a prior name of Five Decades of Consumption and Income Poverty, and this is a title that it's kind of not inconsistent with what Bruce and I like to do. It kind of says what we do, but it doesn't tell you what we find necessarily. And this is exactly what we do. I'm going to show you poverty rates measured by income and consumption over five decades. An editor didn't like this so much, and so he said, do you think you could get a little more attention-grabbing, I think was the word. And so Bruce and I struggled for days, like, how are we going to make this more attention-grabbing? And we finally came up with Dimensions of Progress, Poverty from the Great Society to the Great Recession. And you might notice the obvious hedge here in what we find. And the editor kind of pushed back again and said, you know, can you make it a little punchier? Which then got us to winning the war, the Poverty from the Great Society to the Great Recession. So what was our reluctance? When I show you our results, I think we come down quite confidently and strongly that poverty has fallen dramatically in the U.S. over the past five decades. And does that mean we've won the war? I would argue yes. That means we're not won the war, but we're winning the war on poverty. So why equivocate on that? Well, we want to be careful about what that means in terms of the direct effect of the set of programs that started off with Lyndon Johnson and has progressed and evolved into many other programs. I'm going to show you evidence today that clearly those programs helped in the progress towards the war on poverty, but it's not going to, we can't attribute all of the success necessarily to these programs. So let me start by telling you a little bit about what we're going to do here. We're going to present evidence on how poverty has changed over the past five decades using several different measures of poverty, many different measures of income poverty, and then compare it to a measure of consumption poverty. And then we're going to examine the potential causes, both of the changes over time and why we might see differences between income and consumption-based poverty. Just some administrative details, because I'm not going to talk about data, the specifics of the data after this slide. So all the income results I'm going to present for you today are from the current population survey. That is the source of income data for official inequality and poverty statistics. We're going to give you data from, show you data from 1963 to 2012. I will spend a lot of time focusing on the sub-period from 80 to 2012, because that's when imputed benefits for non-cash transfers like food stamps, housing subsidies, school lunch, and the like are available in the CPS. So that's why we narrow the time period. For consumption, we're going to use the most comprehensive source of expenditure data in the U.S., the Consumer Expenditure Interview Survey, I'm not going to show you every year because it wasn't available in the past annually, but it's been available actually quarterly since 1980, and I won't go into the details of what I mean when I say consumption, although I'm happy to answer questions about that, but know that we follow kind of a standard approach of converting expenditures to consumption. So we use the rental equivalent of the home. We impute the value of owning a car based on the make, model, year of the car. We exclude health expenditures, out-of-pocket health expenditures, but we do this analysis including them as well. So, okay, enough with administrative data. It's kind of silly to ask this question at a conference like this, but I think it's still kind of important to motivate this, is why should we care about poverty? Maybe more specifically, this question is, why should we care about poverty measurement, this official measure of poverty and what that statistic means? And the truth is that this statistic informs a lot about what we think about what's going on at the bottom of the distribution. It is clearly the most cited statistic about what's happening with the worst off. And it's nice to have one succinct measure that tells us about what's going on at the bottom. Now, it's used to evaluate the success of the economy. When the economy grows, does the rising tide lift all boats? People oftentimes look at the poverty rates to assess that. And it's been used a lot, and in particular in recent policy discussions, to evaluate the anti-poverty efforts. And many have said that we have lost the war on poverty. Okay, and conveniently, given the timing of all of this, there have been a lot of news articles in the last few days. Just this past Sunday's New York Times had an article on the war on poverty, and they summarized the opening sentence. To many Americans, the war on poverty has largely failed. So this is a broad perception. What is this broad perception that we've lost the war on poverty based on? Well, it's based on the official poverty statistics. So this is poverty from 1963 to 2012. This is the official numbers. You can get this on the census website. Let me walk through you. 50 years ago yesterday, President Johnson declared an unconditional war on poverty. At the time, poverty rates were falling dramatically, and they continued to fall sharply after 1964. But then they're pretty stagnant after that point. And by 1988, so 2.5 decades later, Ronald Reagan says in his last State of the Union address, my friends, some years ago, the federal government declared a war on poverty, and poverty won. What's his evidence for drawing that conclusion? Well, it's that the poverty rate is basically the same, a little bit higher than it was in 1970. Okay, so we make some progress between 64 and 70, and not much changes according to official rate after that. How have we done since Reagan? Well, today we're at 15% according to the official measure. This is the basis for a lot of very strong policy conclusions about what we should do in terms of the structure of anti-poverty program. Let me just pick on a few things. So this is the Cato Institute. Michael Tanner has said, well, we spent trillions of dollars each year on fighting poverty, and it's basically been wasted. What evidence does he present to say that it's been wasted? He presents the figure that I just showed you. So it's the failure to reduce official poverty. Paul Ryan is building an agenda around this, and Marco Rubio yesterday talked about this. So we're hearing a lot of talk about the loss, that we've lost this, the war on poverty. It's not, by the way, only isolated to the conservative side. Others are citing these high poverty rates on the other side of the political distribution to argue that we need the greater need for government programs because our poverty rates are so high. And in that context, they say, and worse than they've been in 3 decades. So I want to talk a little bit about what the problems and issues are with the official poverty measure, and then we'll talk about other alternative measures. And there are a whole slew of issues that people have brought up. I see that Theses got Measuring Poverty, which is an NAS panel book that in 1985 that summarizes all of these issues. A lot of them are not as relevant for this discussion because they're focusing about measuring poverty at a point in time. And our focus is about changes in poverty over the past 5 decades. So we're focusing on changes. So I'm not going to tell you so much about the appropriate equivalent scale or the appropriate resource sharing unit. What really matters for getting changes in poverty over time correct, and when I say changes in poverty, I'm thinking about an absolute poverty measure, which is how the official measure is designed and what it's designed to be, there are two really important factors that mean that the official poverty measure just gets it wrong. Okay, the first is that is this adjusting for inflation. Okay, there's well-known bias in the CPI that's used to adjust poverty thresholds. That matters a lot for what we get from the official poverty measure. The other is resources, the resources that are included in the measure of poverty. So let me take these two in turn because these are critically important. So first, adjusting for inflation. This is the issue, by the way, that gets much less attention, although it's starting to get more and more attention nowadays, whereas the resources have been getting a lot of attention in the poverty measurement literature. So adjusting for inflation, there's a well-known bias in the CPIU. And the Boskin Commission came out in the mid-90s, concluded that the bias is over 1 percentage point per year. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, to their credit, has incorporated many changes into the CPIU in order to address some of these biases. So what bias I'm talking about, there's substitution bias, there's outlet bias, quality goods bias, and the introduction of new goods bias are kind of the four that are emphasized the most. Other studies suggest that in the 80s, the bias was as much as 3 percentage points. So Costa and Hamilton have a paper that suggests that much. The BLS now and the census now put out a price index that incorporates the new methods of calculating the CPIU and go backwards. So that's called the CPIU RS or research series. And a point that Bruce and I make is that addresses some but not all of the bias. When you're looking at year-to-year changes in dollar amounts, this isn't going to matter so much. When you're looking over five decades, this matters a tremendous amount. So what Bruce, I want to be clear exactly what we do, because some of you might say, why are their numbers a lot more positive than other things that I've seen out there that do what I thought were similar things? Well, this is the reason why, and I want to be very clear, and I want to defend it. So we could adjust the poverty thresholds using the CPIU RS, But the point is that that doesn't go far enough, given the best estimates and the broad consensus in the CPI bias literature. So what we do is we incorporate the what we think is a reasonable midpoint in the estimates of the additional bias that the, that aren't addressed by the CPI URS, and add that in each, incorporate that each year. So it's an additional 0.8 percentage points per year to get to kind of what the Boskin Commission was recommending. So when I say inflation adjusted here, that's what I mean. I'm incorporating not just the bias that's addressed by the CPI URS, but the additional 0.8 percentage points. And you'll see everything I show you is going to be inflation adjusted. This is going to matter when I compare the official to other measures. But once I start comparing the same measures, they're all going to be using the same price index. So then this issue won't be relevant. So that's the adjusting inflation. Then there's the resources concern, and I think this is pretty well known in this room, but just to review, the official measure excludes a lot of programs that have been key tools in fighting poverty. The food stamp program, these are basically non-cash programs, food stamp program and the earned income tax credit or other tax credits, housing assistance, Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. It seems kind of foolish to use as your metric for gauging the success of the war on poverty a metric that doesn't include the arsenal that you're using to fight the war. So I think that we're not the, by no means we're the first ones to argue this, but and to point this out. But what we are going to emphasize, I think it's been underemphasized in the past, is that this is critically important for changes over time. Okay. For some programs versus others, and we'll want to think about that. The other thing I should note is that these are the programs that have been expanding the most. And actually, I was going to email Hillary to ask her for that nice figure that she put up in the second slide that shows your AFDC, TANF, the value has been declining, while EITC, food stamps, and other programs have been expanding. So we're missing that in the official poverty measure. Okay, so let's start thinking about what happens when you incorporate these into our understanding of poverty. So here is the change in poverty between 1963 and 2012, looking at the official measure. So this is a decline in 4 percentage points. Most of that, you know, it happens in the second half of the 60s, and then it's been kind of fluctuating back and forth with little clear progress. Now what I'm going to do is let me go to 1980 threshold, poverty thresholds, and adjust them forward and backwards using the correct inflation adjustment, as opposed to what the official poverty measure does, which is adjust those thresholds forwards and backwards using the CPIU. And if you do that, this is the pattern you find. That's the only change I've made here is just to change the price index that adjusts the thresholds. And what you find is between that period, the poverty rate has gone down by 19 percentage points. Okay, so this already, I could pretty much end here, right, in terms of addressing the issues that I talked about, in terms of what's my response to Michael Tanner or to Paul Ryan. It's we haven't lost, or to Ronald Reagan, we haven't lost the war on poverty based on the evidence that you're presenting. Okay, you can give me other evidence maybe, but based on the evidence that you're presenting, if you do it correctly, the evidence would actually support success in the war on poverty. So this is just making that one simple change. You get this decline of 19 percentage points. I want to then look at what happens when you add non-cash benefits. Okay. So what I've done, I'm in the war room with Wolf Blitzer. I've focused in on the 1980 to 2012 period. This is just the exact same figure I just had, but just cutting off the first couple of decades. And so since 1980, when you adjust for inflation, you get a 3 percentage point decline, whereas the official measures suggest that poverty's gone up by two percentage points. And what happens if we add taxes, food stamps, housing subsidies, school lunch? When you do that, you get the following pattern. Let me be clear, by the way, what I did here is I take that measure, and in 1980, I find the point in the distribution that gives me a poverty rate of 13%. So we anchor the poverty rates in 1980, and then I adjust that, whatever that threshold is, I adjust it over time using the CPIU. So these are both using the same price index. The only difference between these two is that this thing, the resources that you compare to the threshold includes those non-cash benefits and taxes. So you get an additional 2 percentage point decline when you do that. I'm going to show you later that the bulk of this is taxes, but then I want to be clear on what that means in terms of the effect of food stamps and other things. Okay, so that's looking at what happens when you address some of the well-known issues with the official poverty measure. Now I want to move into thinking about consumption. And before I show you results for consumption, it's worthwhile to take a step back and say, well, how should we be measuring changes in deprivation or the extent of deprivation in the U.S. population? And what is the right metric to be thinking about? And I think on conceptual grounds, it's pretty clear that consumption is going to do a better job of capturing the economic well-being of a disadvantaged group than is income. And a lot of this is founded in economic theory. You think about the permanent income hypothesis, but income can vary in ways that do not affect well-being. I mean, you could think about somebody who retires and lives off of their assets. Their income goes to zero. Their consumption is not going to go to zero. You much prefer to look at their consumption than look at their income. And this could have, you know, people, you could take time off. Even people who become unemployed, if they have assets or can borrow, they might be able to smooth consumption over. There are incentives to smooth consumption over variable income. Putting it even more succinctly, consumption is what enters the utility function, not income. And so what we really care about is consumption. But it even goes beyond that. So beyond doing a better job of capturing long-run resources, consumption is going to capture things that income will not, like the benefit of access to public programs. So you can do the insurance value of government programs. So think about the Affordable Care Act and providing Medicaid to a broader population. This group that becomes eligible for Medicaid, that frees up resources that used to have to be either saved for a rainy day or allocated towards health insurance, can now be freed up and spent on other non-medical expenses. So you would see it in their consumption behavior, even if their income streams never change. Okay, so consumption captures these things potentially, whereas income would not. You can make the same kind of arguments about access to credit. There's been a lot of talk about there's greater access to credit for a broader population. This enables them to consume more. Maybe it enables them to consumption smooth better. You're going to see that in their consumption behavior, but not their income behavior. Some of you say, well, sure, but what about overspending and people then are facing bankruptcy? Well, you'd see that in their consumption behavior as well. I mean, the overspending story, when you're consuming a lot, we see that in your consumption behavior. Presumably, your well-being is higher. Then you have to declare bankruptcy and your consumption falls because of it. We're going to capture that in your consumption behavior, even if all the while you never lost your job and your income stream stayed the same through the whole period. Changes in asset prices. You know, here we in the Great Recession, we saw sharp declines in equity prices. Case-Shiller housing prices declined sharply. We can show you people's consumption responded to that. Even for those people who's never lost their jobs or their income didn't change, and so we'll see that response in consumption, but not income. So I think on conceptual grounds, it makes sense. The argument's pretty clear that you'd prefer all else being equal to look at consumption instead of income to measure one's well-being. But then you're probably thinking, but isn't income easier to report? After all, in a few weeks, we're all going to get our W-2s, and our W-2 is going to have almost all of our income on it. So in March, when the CPS calls you and asks you what's your income, you're going to be able to tell them with pretty fair amount of precision what your income is, because most of your income is from earnings. The problem is that that's not the same story for the poor. Okay, much of their income is not from W-2 income or W-2 earnings. It tends to be more sporadic and from odds and ends income, and is harder to collect. In fact, we have pretty good ethnographic evidence that people in deep poverty do a much better job of reporting their consumption than their income. Eden and Lane, Making Ends Meet is the reference there. So the story where you might think it's for somebody at the middle of the distribution or above, it's easier to report their income. For the bottom, the reverse is true. And also you might say, well, how can I possibly remember all the things that I spend money on? Remember what's making up your consumption bundle for the poor. A large fraction, nearly 3/4 of their consumption when you get into the bottom, is food and housing. And so if you can say what's your rent and how much do you spend in a typical week at a grocery store, you're getting a long ways of getting consumption correctly. Okay? So even on these reporting issues, there's evidence that we should prefer consumption as a measure of well-being for the poor than income. And Bruce and I have pieced together in other papers a bunch of evidence to support this, okay? So one, I think, of the most compelling pieces of evidence is just look at people at the very bottom of the distribution. If you look at the low percentiles of expenditures, it greatly exceeds low percentiles of income. If you look at the bottom decile of high school dropout single mothers, so this is really, really poorly off families, you've got, they outspend their income by a factor of 7. If you look at their assets or debts, it cannot be explained by assets or debts. What's going on? We're not capturing all of their income. If you look at the fifth percentile of income and compared to the fifth percentile of consumption, the consumption exceeds income by 44%. Again, there's no evidence that assets and debts can explain that. So consumption, it looks like consumption just exceeds income, and we don't think that it's over-reporting of consumption. There's also evidence that consumption is more strongly associated with other measures of well-being. The questionnaire, just think about it this way. If somebody were to come to you and say, I'm going to reassign you to the bottom of the distribution, and you said, what distribution? The consumption or income distribution, he said, I'll let you pick. You should definitely pick the bottom of the income distribution, because on average, people at the bottom of the income distribution just look better off than people at the bottom of the consumption distribution. You name it, car ownership, home ownership, whether or not there's air conditioning, education, take up of participation in government programs, you look worse if you're in the bottom of the consumption distribution than the bottom of the income distribution. There's also this issue of underreporting of means-tested transfers. So when you go into surveys, and here what we've done is we compare the total dollars given out, reported in the CPS for various programs. So you just multiply by the population weights to get total AFTC dollars, and compare that to what the government says they're giving out in AFTC TANF dollars. In 1975, that was about 78%. By 2004, it's closer to 50%. If you extend these numbers closer to today, you've got both food stamps and welfare dollars below 50%. In other words, the CPS is getting less than half of food stamp and welfare dollars today in their surveys. And so if you imagine using those numbers to look at the impact of those programs on poverty, you're going to dramatically understate the impact of those programs if you're looking at the reported dollars in the CPS and the Purdue. Okay, so, but hasn't consumption data gotten worse as well? And that is a broad perception, and it's based off of information looking at aggregates. So if you look at consumption, you see total consumption reported in the Consumer Expenditure Survey compared to the national income accounts and product accounts and what they say aggregate expenditures are. It was 80% back in 1984, and it's fallen to about 60% today. So the argument is these are low and have been declining. The problem is that this isn't an apples-to-apples comparison. Thesia has done a lot of work on this and has been very helpful in work that we've done. What you want to do, two key points here. What you want to do is make sure that you're comparing the numerator and denominator lineup, which is not the case here. You don't want to put weight on components of consumption that are not as important for the poor. So what's important for the poor? Food, housing, transportation. Let's look at how those line up and how what's happened over time. So this is total spending in the Consumer Expenditure Survey compared to national income and product accounts, new motor vehicles, and owner-occupied housing. So that's the rental equivalent of your own home. That ratio is at 1 and steady over time. What about rent and utilities? Rent and utilities hovers around 1, and it's very stable over time. What about food at home? It's at about 0.9 and very stable over time. So the components of consumption that are key for the poor are actually measured quite well, while the components of income that are essential to those at the bottom of the distribution are measured poorly, and it's been declining over time. Okay, so it's sorry to be a naysayer, because I know many of us use that income data, including myself in the past. So consumption, now let's look at those consumption income poverty results. So I've showed you this already. This is the disposable income measure of poverty over the past 3 decades, a decline of 5 percentage points. What happens if I do the same thing looking at consumption? You have a decline of 9 percentage points. So we see an even greater improvement indicated by our measure of consumption. And we would argue that you should prefer the measure of consumption for the reasons I just talked about. If it's even worse if you look at deep poverty. And so here you capture deep poverty when you look at poverty gaps. the amount of dollars it would take to take everybody below the poverty line and bring them up to the poverty line. That poverty gap for income has been increasing over time, which is what you'd expect to see with increasing underreporting, while the poverty gap for consumption declined a bit and has been fairly steady, or no clear trend after that. So they've moved in opposite directions, essentially, over time. Okay, if you don't like income measure or consumption measure, you don't like the price index, you're saying, I don't know what to believe with all of this they're doing with the data. Let's just look at independent indicators of well-being and say, what's happened to people over time? What's happened to the number of, so here I'm just going to look at people at the bottom quintile of the income distribution. And I could go back to the 60s and this evidence, the trend continues backwards. We've seen an increase in the number of rooms. Noticeable increase in the size of the housing units. We talk about McMansions, it's happening at the top of the distribution. It's happening at the bottom of the distribution as well. Okay, so you see that. I'm not going to say that to the same degree, okay, but it is happening. Fraction of homes that have air conditioning, that's improved dramatically. If you go back to the 60s, it's below 10%. This again is the bottom income quintile. Fraction that own a car. I could give you figure after figure after figure that shows these kind of other indicators that suggest improvements in well-being. The bottom. It's hard to reconcile this with a clear statement that we've lost the war on poverty. Okay, so that's the evidence on changes. Let me then now focus on kind of what are the potential explanations for this. And the first thing we'll consider, is it changing demographics? Well, is it just the composition of the population of the U.S. has changed, marital status has changed, education has changed, employment? So basically what we do is we define demographic cells and we hold the within-cell poverty rates constant and let demographics change and see what happens to poverty. Hillary and co-authors and Marianne and Anne, right, have a paper that do this very nicely, a JEP paper that looks at the changes in demographic characteristics and its effect on official poverty. So we're doing a similar thing here. Blue bars are what actually happened to consumption poverty. If you hold poverty rates within family type employment cells constant and then let family type and employment change over time, that predicts poverty to change very little or even rise, which I actually think is consistent with stuff that you find on family type in your paper. So it's going the wrong direction. So family type and employment don't seem to be to explain the decline in consumption poverty. If you then add to that on education, indicators for education, that does explain some of the decline in poverty, but not all the decline in poverty, in consumption poverty. Okay? We could do the same. So education clearly played a role here, the fact that the bottom of the distribution is getting more educated over time. If you do the same thing for income, you see the same patterns. The education just isn't as predictive as it was for consumption poverty. So let's think about changes in other policies, or in particular changes in policies, because changes in demographics alone are not going to explain this, changes in poverty. And so I'm going to think about different policies kind of step by step, and these all, I should acknowledge, ignore kind of the behavioral effects of these programs. Other people have argued that those behavioral effects are going to be small relative to the direct effects, but I don't think that people are going to argue that they're non-existent. So here is what I've done is just take pre-tax and after-tax income poverty. Okay, same price index, so I don't have to worry about the price index issue. This is basically what happens if I start with pre-tax and then I run the whole CPS through Taxim. So this is mostly the earned income tax credit, but I want to point out that other tax policies are evident here. In other words, you can see the effect of tax policy on poverty rates. Let me kind of step through just a few here. So the Economic Relief Tax Act of 1981, that actually hurt the poor. So their poverty rates are rising faster when you incorporate that. Well, remember, they lowered marginal tax rates, but what it did, the standard deduction and personal exemption were not indexed to inflation until 1984, and this was a high inflation period. So more of their income was taxable for the poor during that period, and that hurt them, and then it started to be indexed by inflation and they did better. Then came the Tax Relief Act of 1986, where we started to expand the earned income tax credit, and you start to see the red line declining or rising less than the blue line. And then you really see it in these three expansions of the earned income tax credit, where after-tax poverty starts to fall more than pre-tax poverty. So over the last three decades, 2 percentage point difference is the effect of changes in tax policy on poverty rates. What about changes in government cash transfers? So these are transfers that are included in the official poverty measure. Mainly I'm thinking about Social Security, unemployment insurance. You'd also include workers' comp and disability and the like. So what is the effect of that program? And the answer is that it's quite large. Over the past three decades, it's a difference of about 3.5 percentage points. What we do here is compare money income, so the same inflation measure used, inflation adjustment, but we compare money income to, now I'm just going to take away Social Security, unemployment insurance, and the like, and see what happens to people's poverty rates. And you see that poverty will fall by 3.5 percentage points more when you include those programs. I'll tell you, most of this is Social Security. And let me also be clear here what happens when I anchor. When I anchor, I'm wiping away the effect at the beginning. So I'm forcing the poverty rates to be the same. Clearly, Social Security would lower the poverty rate in 1980. I'm forcing them to be the same and saying, what's going to happen since 1980? So now, in order for Social Security to have an effect, it needs to become essentially more generous than it was in 1980. Right, which is actually what has happened, because Social Security is indexed to wages. The real value of Social Security benefits has, when people start to collect it, has grown over time. And as a result, you see that there's been this noticeable effect. I will say it's interesting when you look at the cyclical patterns and focus in on that, you really see the effect of unemployment insurance as well. But much of this is due to Social Security. Now, you can see this when in a separate paper, Bruce and I focus on the elderly. And there's probably no greater success story than what's happened to the extent of deprivation amongst those over 65 in the U.S. Here is just anchoring the thresholds again in 1980 for the overall population. And then this is using consumption and then the same price index adjustment. You see this dramatic 45 percentage point decline in poverty. Now, just people might have thought, well, I thought Ken said that it dropped sharply and then was fairly stable. He's right. That's true. What happened to the official poverty measure? That's what happened. The official poverty measure dramatically understates improvements in well-being that have happened to the elderly early on and even since the 60s. So this is a clear success story which happened to the elderly, and it's due in no small part to Social Security. What about changes in government non-cash transfers? So here the news based on the evidence I'm going to show you is not so good. So if we look at a measure, these are both after tax, so including taxes in both, same price adjustment. One does not include food stamps, housing subsidies, school lunch. One does, and you see that the changes are very similar. So the conclusion one would draw using CPS income data, which many people have, is that it has very little, these non-cash benefits have very little impact on changes in poverty over time. Now, Hillary has pushed us on this a couple of times, and so I'm going to be very clear on qualifying this. Two qualifications. The one that Hillary points out is that, sure, this might be true, but it has a dramatic effect at any point in time. And when we say these things like it has no effect on changes of poverty over time, that might just get obscured. And Hillary showed you results earlier today that showed you that after Social Security and EITC, food stamps lifts more people out of poverty than any of these means tested transfer programs. It reduces poverty by 1.6 percentage points at a point in time. But what about the change over time? Okay. So that's one qualification. I'm getting rid of the effect of these programs in 1980 by anchoring them and then seeing what happens since then. But then you're probably thinking, well, I thought Hillary also showed us that food stamps spending has been rising over time. But then you have to couple that with the figure that that's administrative data. And couple the figure I showed you about the CPS, which shows you that the amount of food stamps that we're capturing the CPS over time has been declining. And so we're missing a lot of the impact. So if you just use the value of food stamps or housing subsidies from the CPS without accounting for this underreporting and increase in underreporting, you're gonna miss, as this figure shows, you're gonna miss the impact of these programs. So I'm not saying that food stamps has no effect on reducing poverty rates since 1980. I'm just saying that if you don't account for underreporting, it's gonna look that way. Okay, so why do consumption and income differ? And this will be my last point on the differences, and then I'll conclude. And I've already talked about the measurement error issue, and we really do think that, particularly for measures like the poverty gap, that depend heavily on kind of like the depth of poverty, the reason for the divergence is because of measurement error in income. That income is underreported, and that's been growing over time. So we do think that measurement error is playing a big role, and it's probably playing the biggest role. Some might say, well, you know, we think that income should differ for consumption even without measurement error, because we expect people to consumption smooth, and we might expect people to dissave or save depending on their expected streams of future income. And so what we've done is look at the asset holdings of people. Here's separated by family type, and looked at how much assets these different groups have. And I just picked two different decades to do this for. And if you look at these groups, let's focus on single parents. So the 95th percentile total financial assets for single parents in both the 90s and 2000s is under $1,000. So this is like the wealthiest single parent families, so you're the 95th percentile, is still under $1,000. And so it provides little resources to maintain consumption when income is low, if that's looking at the 95th percentile. Some people have said, well, what's really going on is people are borrowing and they shouldn't be borrowing. Okay, that might be true for the middle class. For people at the bottom of the distribution, so I should emphasize this is, when I say this 95th percentile of single parent families, it's 95th percentile of poor single parent families. So some people, it's not Murphy Brown is not in this. So they also, the poor single parent families don't have a lot of debt. Okay, so this isn't an overconsumption and they're just borrowing story, because they simply don't have a lot of debt. That's clearly going to be an issue further up the distribution, not for this group. One exception might be, so let me draw attention to those over 65. Here's where measurement error might be less important, and assets in particular might be particularly important, okay, as you might expect. So here you start to see substantial assets, even for poor families with a head over 65. You start to see substantial assets, even say at the 75th percentile. So that gives you, room for dissaving and saving to play a role in differences between income and consumption, but it's going to be isolated to just in this case one demographic group, leaving measurement error as probably the main story going on for other demographic groups. Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and conclude. The main point that I'd like to you all to take away here is that we are winning the war on poverty. What that means in terms of the success of specific programs, I think is less clear. I think there's evidence that these programs have helped and have directly led to reductions in poverty. But regardless of which programs are effective and which are not, we've seen a dramatic decline in poverty in the U.S. over the past five decades. And that's evident in consumption data, income data, and even other metrics for economic well-being. If I wanted to pick a few programs where there's some clear evidence of success, here I'm looking at programs that are cash or near cash programs. It's hard to incorporate, say, what the effect of Head Start is in this kind of analysis in terms of its effect. But there's clear evidence of a direct effect of the earned income tax credit in terms of leading to reductions in poverty and expansions in the Social Security program, whether that was by design or not. The increased generosity of the Social Security program has led to dramatic reductions in poverty, particularly for the elderly. Also, though, the consumption poverty falls more than income poverty, and there are reasons why we would prefer consumption poverty, both measurement issues and conceptual issues for why one should prefer to look at consumption poverty instead of income poverty. And saving and borrowing are unlikely to be able to explain much of these differences, with the exception being at the top of the distribution. So, and I try to end all of my talks by saying consumption is preferred for measuring the changes of the well-being of the worst off, but I will leave it at that.